Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have a lot of visitors in the courtroom today. We always like it when the public comes and sees what goes on in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I call our first case of the day, State versus Pope. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. I am Andrea Taylor Cornwall, and I represent Reverend Pope in this case. This case raises the issue of the necessity of a complete transcript to a criminal defendant's constitutional and statutory right to a meaningful appeal, which this court has recognized flows along with the constitutional right to counsel on appeal. In Mr. Pope's unique case, the circuit court properly exercised its discretion in granting the Rule 80930 motion for a new trial because the unavailability of any trial transcripts made it impossible for meaningful appellate review to occur of Mr. Pope's convictions. The Court of Appeals reversed, relying on Perry's colorable need standard to impose a burden to identify a specific error in the trial despite the unavailability of a single transcript from that trial.
Go ahead, Chief, sir.
I started too, but was it just a two?
I'm going to jump in if you guys.
I'm being polite here. I'm going to go. The question is, what do you do with Perry? What do you do with the Perry case? Because it's there. It talks about having to have this colorable claim. It is the law. So what do you do with it? How do you distinguish it?
I don't think that Perry was intended to apply to a situation where all transcripts of the trial are missing.
Why?
It's because it's a portion of the transcript situation. Both Perry and De Leon addressed, and Perry is based upon the methodology set out in De Leon, and both of those cases addressed situations in which a portion of the transcript was missing.
And why is it different if you have the entire transcript missing?
Because if the entire transcript is missing, appellate counsel has no way to determine whether there are any arguable issues to begin with. And this court has said that where appellate counsel is not trial counsel, the only way to identify arguable issues is by a review of the transcript. In the interest of JD, which is cited in my brief.
Counsel, would you please just expand on Justice Dalek's questions? What do you see as the underlying rationale behind Perry? I understand it's a different fact situation and distinguishing on those grounds, but what's the why behind Perry?
The why, I think, behind Perry is that because the defendant, and this is regardless of whether it's civil or criminal, but particularly in a criminal case where the defendant has the constitutional and statutory right to appeal and a right to counsel on appeal, there's simply no way that that right to counsel can be effectuated if counsel is new on the case on appeal particularly and cannot review any portion of the trial to determine whether there is an arguable issue.
So just to make sure I'm reframing this, in your view, implicit in Perry is this idea that the parties or counsel who were involved were there and knew something about it? Are you saying that was sort of required, a foundation on which Perry was built?
Part of it, but I do think it rests primarily on the transcripts, because Perry does specifically talk about the necessity of a full transcript in order to effectuate the right to a meaningful appeal. So, no, I don't think, my position is not if trial counsel then takes on the appeal, that then there is no need for the transcript.
No, I'm trying to just understand how you would justify Perry, tell the reason for Perry underlying it.
But I think Perry is a harmlessness standard in the sense that if most or a substantial portion of the trial exists and there's only a small portion that's missing, that a burden, it makes sense in some ways for a burden to then be imposed upon the appellant to say why that missing portion or that scrambled portion is necessary to have a meaningful appeal, because that's really the right that's underlying, I think, Perry altogether, is the right to a meaningful appeal.
But doesn't that
But doesn't, in Perry, doesn't it presume that the error exists in the missing part of the transcript?
It presumes that it is possible that the error exists, not that it does, because there's certainly no way, we don't know what we don't know.
Right. So if the error was in the part of the transcript that Perry had, we wouldn't be talking about the missing part, right?
Well, the error has to be divined, essentially, from the portion that is in existence, and counsel can review that portion. And in Perry, there were 6 days of an 8-day trial that were in existence. 2 days were missing, and even there, this court found that that wasn't a sufficient transcript for a meaningful appeal. So the appellate counsel in Perry was able to tell from 6 days of trial that there was a potential issue of prosecutorial misconduct. That was one of many issues, actually, that was raised in the appeal in that case. And because parts of the closing argument were missing, the allegation was, well, if I had those portions of the closing argument, we would be able to make out a claim on appeal. But because that portion was missing, I'm unable to do so. But there, again, they had 6 days of an 8-day trial. And even there, this court found that wasn't enough, and Mr. Perry was denied his right to meaningful appeal. In De Leon, there were only 15 minutes of the trial missing, and that, in fact, was a court trial. And there, the court was able to actually reconstruct the record so that the appellant was able to move forward with the meaningful appeal. So I think that underlying Perry is, again, it's the right to a meaningful appeal. And I think the distinction between Perry in this case is that Perry and De Leon were meant to apply a harmlessness standard in the context of a portion missing case. And I simply don't think harmlessness can be applied where none of the trial transcripts are in existence, because there's simply no way for counsel to tell what error there was.
How would you write the principle of law that affirms Perry, but your seeds in this case? I'm imagining, does it matter if it's, 60% of the transcript is gone, or 80%, or 90%? Is your line just only if the whole thing's missing, then we have a slightly different standard, but Perry applies if 90 or 95% of it are missing?
I don't think the court needs to decide a percentage or which amount needs to be missing in order for a meaningful appeal to be denied. I think it's a continuum, it's a spectrum. I think Mr. Pope's case is beyond the spectrum, honestly. I think it's off the spectrum, but I think that it is a continuum. And as Perry discussed, it's a case-by-case analysis, really. It depends on the length of the trial, the length of the missing transcripts, whether the age of the case, the nature of the case, whether the parties can help reconstruct it. So I think all of those factors have to be assessed. I don't think there's a bright-line rule that this court can or should incorporate in its decision in this case. I think that in this situation, prejudice should be presumed without the necessity to assert a specific error as required in Perry. I don't think this court needs to overturn Perry. I think that Perry should be applied as I believe it was intended in portion of the transcript missing cases.
You cite Garza in your reply brief very briefly. Garza of the United States said that an appellate court cannot condition the restoration of a defendant's appellate rights forfeited by ineffective counsel on proof that the defendant's appeal had merit. What impact do you think Garza has on Perry, if any?
I think that that has impact both in what the Court of Appeals held against Mr. Pope in its decision, in which the Court of Appeals said that he that he was wrong in asserting in his statements on transcript, in his pro se reinstatement appeal, that he had all the transcripts he needed for that appeal. The court held that against him, and I think that was wrong. One, because he didn't have to assert that any other transcripts were necessary for that appeal, but the court also held against him that he had not stated in those motions and in that appeal what his issues on appeal are, and that simply is not that's contrary to Garza as well as the underlying SCOTUS cases that relies on, which are Roe versus Flores, Ortega, Rodriguez. I also think that under Garza, Mr. Pope cannot be the resource, held to be the resource for the issues on appeal. It's up to counsel to decide under Jones v. Barnes what issues, arguable issues, there are for appeal. So requiring Mr. Pope to be the resource for what issues there are on appeal, again, denies him his right to counsel, which flows along with the right to a meaningful appeal.
I'm wondering what your position is on the Court of Appeals has already decided the question of reinstatement of his right to appeal. And I bring to your attention that on November 5, 1997, he filed a notice of appeal of the Circuit Court's earlier denial of his motion seeking to reinstate his appeal rights based on ineffective assistance of counsel. Then on December 23, 1997, the Court of Appeals issued an order notifying Pope that he had not filed a statement on transcript for his pending appeal, and this is in regard to reinstating his appeal rights, and directing him to do so within 5 days. On January 20th, Pope files another statement, this time a statement on transcript, saying that the transcripts on file for the preliminary hearing and the sentencing hearing are all that are needed to determine whether his appeal rights should be reinstated. Then March 5, 1999, the Court of Appeals denied his motion to reinstate his appeal rights based on ineffective assistance of counsel. So that's a decision by the Court of Appeals. I feel like we're doing the same thing over again. What he wants now is to reinstate his appeal rights. Why isn't that March 5th, 1999 decision of the Court of Appeals dispositive of the claims you bring before us?
Well, respectfully, Chief Justice, we are in direct appeal now. This is not a habeas action. So his direct appeal rights have, in fact, already been reinstated
but
by the Court of
Appeals.
But
that's by stipulation.
Correct.
And okay, the court, that's a different question. I understand the stipulation of the state, and there are arguments that are made that the stipulation was based on a mutual mistake of fact. Nobody knew. There were no transcripts at that time, and it probably seemed like just a good way to move this matter forward to conclusion. But that's not my question. Aside from what the state did or didn't do, why isn't the March 5th, 1999 denial of his request to reinstate his direct appeal rights the end of the story here?
I don't think it is the end of the story because under Mr. Pope's petition based on a Knight petition based on Kyle's, he then alleged ineffective assistance of his trial counsel for failure to have filed the notice of intent. And that's what the stipulation and the reinstatement was based on. So that the March 5th, 1999 decision did not address the ineffectiveness of trial counsel in failing to have filed the notice of intent.
Can you also address the sentencing transcript filing that he made as well? Because he said he didn't need anything else, so why can't we rely on that?
Certainly. And admittedly, the preliminary hearing transcript and sentencing transcripts are in the record. And the reason that they're in the record is they were, by statute, the sentencing transcript, and I believe the trial attorney had ordered the preliminary hearing transcript. But those are not relevant to an appeal of his for determination of guilt. So there's neither of those transcripts have any relevance to his convictions.
Right, but he said they did. He said that was all that was needed. How come we can't rely on his statement of transcript?
Except that, again, the appeal that he pursued in 1997 was an appeal of the Circuit Court's denial of reinstatement of his direct appeal rights. It was right. Not his direct appeal. So the only thing he was appealing the Circuit Court's order denying reinstatement. And so he was only required to certify in that statement on transcript which transcripts, if any, were necessary for appeal of that Circuit Court order, not for the direct appeal itself. Had the Court of Appeals reinstated his direct appeal at that time and reversed the Circuit Court, then he would have filed a notice of intent, and then an attorney would have been appointed, and had merit been found, the attorney would have ordered transcripts, first of all, under 80930, and then would have pursued an appeal and filed a notice of appeal and statement on transcript in that direct appeal, which is a separate action from seeking to overturn the circuit court order denying the reinstatement motion. So the statement on transcript that he filed, I think, was perfectly proper under 809.11.4b. But to the extent that this Court may believe it was not, that should any missteps that he made while he was involuntarily unrepresented by counsel because his lawyer did not file the notice of intent are to be imputed against the State, not against Mr. Pope. And that's Coleman versus Thompson, which is cited in my brief. So even if that was a misstep on his behalf, and I don't believe it is under my reading of 809.11, sub 4, sub b, I don't think that can be held against him.
Will you address the State's second argument as well?
Certainly.
That this agreement to reinstate the direct appeal, the State didn't know there weren't transcripts, and what about putting him back to habeas? What about proceeding that way and letting the State go ahead and make a latches argument at that point if that's what they choose to do?
Initially, I think, again, I think they waived that argument. That was not raised below. Secondly, I think it was a strategic waiver of any latches defense. They had the opportunity, if they had a latches defense, to raise it in habeas. They stipulated. In terms of whether it was a knowing waiver, that was not, the stipulation was not based upon whether or not transcripts existed, whether or not the State would win or lose. It was based upon the ineffective assistance of Mr. Pope's trial counsel for failing to have filed the notice of intent. And I don't think that this Court should or can now rescind that waiver and reinstate what is a dismissed habeas petition. That would really be unprecedented, simply because the State now wishes it had not entered into what was a...
You advance that this Court cannot reinstate a dismissed habeas. It was with interest that I read and was reminded, of course, that habeas is civil.
Correct.
Is there any authority in the context of a criminal case to remand for a totally separate case, separate file that's civil, that has been dismissed? Is there any, I wasn't able to find any, but are there any examples that we have, that's not in our normal pipeline, of course. It's a different case, different number, different area.
I agree. I think they are separate actions. The habeas is civil. It was dismissed, again, based upon the joint stipulation and request to dismiss, the joint stipulation to reinstatement and request to dismiss the habeas. So, and again, the State was represented on that. That was not as though this was done without them. The Attorney General's office stipulated to that reinstatement, and it was based upon the factual findings that Judge Watts made upon the remand, which, in effect, I believe the State concedes in its brief that that established prejudice to Mr. Pope based on the ineffective assistance of his trial counsel for failing to have filed the notice of intent.
Counsel, can I turn your attention back to Perry for just a moment?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that in a circumstance in which only part of the transcript exists, but none of the existing pieces of the transcript point to any colorable claim of error. Okay. Why would the defendant not be able to point to the missing part and say, it must have been in there, and so I get a new trial?
I think it depends on what portions are missing and what type of trial it is. I think if the existing portion didn't have perhaps sufficient evidence within the missing portion, perhaps sufficiency could be credibly argued in terms of, you know, the existing portion doesn't show sufficient evidence.
Well, any possible error could exist in the missing part of the transcript, right?
Correct.
Okay. So why would a defendant not be able to point to the missing piece of the transcript and say, I'm not able to exercise my full appellate rights because I can't look at the missing part of the transcript to see if there's any error there?
Again, I think it depends on how much is missing. I certainly think that is possible nothing is in the portion that they have and there's still a substantial portion.
Why would that depend on anything? I mean, there's always the possibility of error being the missing part, regardless of how much is missing and which part of the trial it is, right?
There's always the possibility, yes, because, again, we don't know what we don't know. But
exactly.
Where we have no transcripts.
And that's the situation we have here. We don't know what we don't know.
Is there a...
So if we adopt your rule here and say, because we don't know what we don't know, in this case, there must be a new trial, isn't every defendant going to be able to say the same thing in a partial transcript case?
I don't think so, because, again, I think it depends on whether they can have a meaningful appeal with the part that exists.
Well, they can't have a meaningful appeal if they say the error is in the missing part, can they?
Well, again, I think there would have to be some claim made there with the portion that exists. And, again, depending on the type of trial,
But if the part that exists doesn't point to an error, and the defendant says the exact same thing that Pope is saying here, I don't know what I don't know, why doesn't that entitle him to a new trial?
I think if it denies him a meaningful appeal and it's a significant enough trial and that portion can't be reconstructed, then that may be a situation where a new trial would have to be granted.
Doesn't that swallow Perry?
I don't think so. I think that, again, it is a case-by-case situation. Perry doesn't cover every situation, but it does cover the portion of the transcript missing cases. And this, I think, is just off the spectrum. We've got no transcripts of the trial, and it's just impossible for a meaningful appellate review on a full transcript to occur. But I do think that the more of the transcript that's missing, the less possible it is, and that's addressed in Perry and Cole versus United States, upon which Perry and De Leon rely, that the more of a transcript that's missing, the more likely it is that a meaningful appellate review is...
Okay. So if we say 25% of the transcript is missing, there's a lower likelihood that you don't have a meaningful chance of review. If there's 70% missing, there's a higher percentage. But in neither circumstance are you able to point to any colorable claim of error.
Again, I think I don't think it's a percentage basis. I think it depends on the circumstance of the case. But where there are no transcripts and where counsel has no ability to identify any error in the transcript, I think prejudice has to be presumed because there's no ability. And again, in terms of where there are some portions and not others, I think that Perry can be applied typically, but there may be circumstances where there is such a great deficiency in the record that prejudice has to be presumed.
So do we assume the existence of error depending on the amount of the transcript that's missing?
I don't think it's depending on the amount, no. I think it's depending upon which portion, in the portion of transcript cases, I think it depends on which portion, how long the trial is, how much is missing.
Give me some guidelines. What would we, because at some point we have to write something, and we have to say, if we go along with you on this, we're going to have to say why Perry doesn't require some presentation of a colorable claim.
I think because I'm sorry.
Yeah, so if it's the part of the transcript, you know, what part of the trial are you in? Are you in opening statements, closing arguments, presentation? Whatever it might be, is it that? So give me the list of factors that we would use to decide whether Perry applies or we just assume error.
I think the list of factors, again, if we're talking about a portion of transcript case, is the length of the case, how much is missing,
age and nature. Percentage of what's missing.
What Not else? Percentage necessarily, oh. But the length and which
length
portions.
Length and some portion, mm-hmm. You can do the division and it works out to a percentage. All right. Amount that's missing out of the full trial. What else?
I'm sorry?
Besides the amount that's missing,
I think
what
it really depends on whether counsel is able to review the record to determine whether there are arguable issues.
Well, he's never going to be able to review the part that doesn't exist.
Again, depending on which portion is missing and what the nature of the case is and the type of case, counsel may be able to determine. But I think with no trial transcripts at all, it's impossible for counsel to make a specific allegation of it.
Are you asking for a narrow ruling that would apply only to these extraordinary circumstances where there is absolutely no transcript whatsoever? And my second question is, do you think that the trial court made an implicit finding that it was not possible to reconstruct the trial proceedings based on the complete absence of a transcript?
I believe, yes. I believe, I'm asking for a narrow ruling that does not apply Perry to this particular situation where all the transcripts are missing, such that counsel is unable to determine whether any arguable issues exist. And I believe that Judge Conan implicitly found, based on the age of the case and the absolute absence of any trial transcript, and the trial attorney not having any memory of the case and no file, that reconstruction could not occur in this case.
Does it also matter in this case in terms of the facts that this is not a situation where, when we talk about making a colorable claim, where an attorney has made a colorable claim, that this is a situation where he's never had the benefit of any counsel to then look at any record to determine if there's a claim? How does that play into your
argument? I absolutely think it in effect, is the denial of counsel, because counsel is unable to determine from the record what issues might exist.
So if we applied Perry, we'd be requiring pro se defendants, in this type of circumstance, a pro se defendant who never had the benefit of the counsel would be the one responsible for identifying that color.
It, in effect, puts him in that position because it denies him his right to counsel, because counsel has no way to determine whether there are any specific errors that could be alleged.
And why shouldn't we have put it to him to say what he thought was wrong with the trial?
Because he has the right to counsel on appeal, and he has the right to a constitutional and statutory right to a meaningful appeal. I see my light is on.
You can finish answering Justice Dallet's question if you've not. If you have, that's fine.
I've answered it, I think.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien appears on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. Counsel is absolutely correct. The judgment of the conviction is the paramount event here. That judgment was entered in 1996. When Pope was allowed to an out-of-time reinstatement of his right to directly challenge that judgment 20 years later, Pope had to do what every single criminal and civil appellant in the state must do when directly challenging a judgment against them: allege error. Pope didn't do that.
Pope How could must he do also, that without the benefit of counsel?
He has the benefit of counsel now. Counsel filed post-conviction
counsel
motion.
Who didn't participate in a trial that happened over 2 decades ago.
Pardon me?
Counsel that did not participate in the trial over 2 decades ago.
Correct. But we often have that situation where appeals are filed many years after the fact and new counsel is around. Counsel still has to allege error, even when that's quite difficult, even when trial attorneys are deceased, no longer around, when records are depleted. That's nothing new. The fact is, every direct appellant challenging every judgment in the state must allege error.
So you would expect an attorney right now, without the benefit of a transcript, to allege error. That's what you want us to find. Because now he's got his right to counsel, that attorney should allege error. How is that attorney supposed to do that? Just guess?
It's quite clear from Perry that is a threshold requirement. And the De Leon case says that's a matter of common sense. You don't pursue an appeal without alleging error. And let's not forget that every appellant, and again, this is a direct appeal, every appellant is responsible for the record, the quality, the sufficiency of the record. If the record is deficient, that appellant loses. But Perry, this court, gave defendants who have not been provided significant portions of the transcript and out in Perry. And this court said, all right, even though you would normally lose because the record's deficient, you won't if you allege colorable, arguably reversible error, and we can reconstruct what happened even without the transcript.
Counsel, the question that was presented by Justice Dallet was how in this case is it supposed to happen? How are they going to be able to show colorable error? under the facts of this case?
Well, again,
Is it an impossibility? I mean, then that kind of...
Well, I think that's incorrect. Sense. That's okay. incorrect to say it's impossible.
Okay.
First of all, there are... The transcript's gone, but there are two transcripts in the record you can work off. There are witnesses.
Now, the transcripts that are in the record, one is the preliminary hearing transcript. Is that correct?
At which several of the trial witnesses testified, yes.
Okay. And you also advanced that you could maybe look at newspaper articles. Is that another source?
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of... Plus, as in any trial, you have the trial... Appellate attorneys just talk the case over with trial attorneys all the time to find out what happened. You have your own client to find out what happened. You have witnesses that may still be available to find out what happened. You have other lawyers for the other defendants.
How can you look at a preliminary hearing transcript, which by its very nature is circumscribed, to determine if there is trial error? The transcript of the trial is missing. And so how can you look at a circumscribed preliminary hearing transcript, different hearing, different date, different things happen, of course, different purpose, and determine if there's any seems to me far-fetched. Tell me why it isn't far-fetched.
Well, I don't think it's far-fetched if those same witnesses testified at trial.
But what's the error? I mean, preliminary hearing is so different in its scope and purpose.
I understand, but we're not just relying on the preliminary hearing. There are other, and I think I've tried to reconstruct in my brief just how likely it is that this trial proceeded fairly. And again, we know who all the witnesses were. We know that Mr. Pope testified in his own defense. We know that several of the witnesses who testified at the preliminary testified at trial. We know that two of the co-defendants testified against Pope and pointed the finger at him.
Aren't you really arguing that we know he's guilty? That's what it sounds like to me. You're arguing, look, we know he's guilty. We don't know what went on in the actual trial, but we know he's guilty. That's what I hear you arguing now and what I really saw you arguing in your brief. In a case where there's absolutely no transcript.
We're arguing, we know that Pope has offered no reason to challenge the jury's verdict, finding him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in 23 years.
Counsel, we've been talking a little bit about Perry this morning so far. I want to turn to a different part of Perry. It says, a thread runs through our entire jurisprudence that there not only be a right to an appeal, but that the appeal be a meaningful one. In order that the right be meaningful, our law requires that a defendant be furnished a full transcript. And then it goes on to say, any failure of the appellate process which prevents a putative appellant from demonstrating possible error constitutes a constitutional deprivation of the right to trial. Yeah? So, he didn't get a full transcript. And because he doesn't have a full transcript, he has no way of identifying an error. Why is that not a prima facie violation of his constitutional right to an appeal?
Because we have the situation where, and other courts have dealt with this situation as well, where transcripts, for whatever reason, are not available. It's not an automatic rule that you reverse because the transcripts are not available. What you do is what the federal courts do under the federal rule, which is almost identical to the Perry situation, is there is, regardless of how difficult it is, there is a threshold burden to allege some colorable claim of error. Now,
let me just stop you at the point, because the analysis in Perry seems to go in a stepwise fashion. And it first talks about the availability of the transcript, and then it talks about identifying errors to the appellate courts, right? I mean, you kind of have to go in that order. You got to have the transcript so you can identify the error, so you can tell the appeals court there's an error. If the predicate is completely gone, how is the defendant supposed to do the second step?
Well, no, I disagree. I think the whole point of Perry is we don't have a transcript. What do we do when there's no transcript? You identify a colorable claim of error, and then we try to reconstruct what happened during the missing portion of the transcript, of that portion of the trial. So, no, that's not a we assume that there isn't a transcript. And Perry says, but you still must make a colorable showing. And De Leon, on which it relies and on which the Court of Appeals quoted, says it's a matter of common sense to have to allege error. Obviously, the court doesn't need to consider the claim if he does not allege any sort of arguably meritorious error occurring.
The reply brief cites, in the interest of J.D., a Supreme Court decision from 1982 from this court. The court said there is no way appellate counsel can determine if there is arguable merit for the appeal without either having been the trial attorney or reading the transcript. How would you distinguish this case? How would you apply that rule?
Well, again, I don't think that was meant to supersede Perry, which I think, again, how do we deal with it? Perry, the court said, a significant portion of the transcript was missing. How do we deal with that situation? And yes, there are some cases where the absence of transcript, because there's very little else in the record, might be determinative. But there still must be some, again, and the Court of Appeals said it's a burden, it's not a significant burden, but it's a burden nonetheless that it's a threshold he must cross to make a showing of, to allege that some reversible error occurred. And again, you know, we're 23 years out. If this was a year after the trial, it would be, even if there was, for whatever reason, no transcript was provided, the court reporter lost their notes.
So what if a defendant...
But you have all kinds of sources to review to determine whether an arguable error occurred.
What if a defendant just made something up, knowing that this is the law of the land in Wisconsin, you got to allege some error... A jailhouse lawyer, since he's proceeding pro se, tells him, just make something up.
Well, there's that possibility, but again, then we explore that at the Perry hearing, that you determine, as you try to reconstruct things, whether this really happened.
How would anybody know at that point? I mean, you would acknowledge, right, this is an extraordinary case. I don't think there's any other case that anybody's been able to find that is like this one.
Well, it's extraordinary largely due to the passage of time here. It's not necessarily extraordinary that you have cases where transcripts can't be found or can't be aren't filed for whatever reason, and you're trying to reconstruct. I think the Court of Appeals was quite clear that, yeah, even in a case like this, you've got to make some colorable showing that there was an error.
Counsel, I want to know if you agree with opposing counsel that the state cannot be permitted to now try to prove laches, given the stipulation and the statement that the state has agreed to dismiss the habeas. So laches is gone.
No, because, I disagree, because as Kyles v. Pollard held, as this court held in Kyles v. Pollard, all this did was to allow Mr. Pope to pursue untimely post-conviction relief. There was no stipulation to anything else. There was nothing in the stipulation saying, and therefore we waive any defenses, including laches. And as this court held in Coleman v. Perry, I believe it's footnote 13, on remand, the laches defense can be considered when discussing claims of ineffective assistance or suppression motion or the fairness of the trial and things of that nature. So I think that all we agreed to was that he can file an out-of-time direct challenge to his conviction. We did not agree that he does not have to allege any error occurred. We did not agree that Perry does not apply here.
When is the first time, because all of this argument really focuses on untimeliness and unreasonableness in part on the defendant. When is the first time that the state attempted to raise latches in this case? How many years after the judgment of conviction?
The same year that Mr. Pope made that issue relevant, 2014, when he filed his Knight petition. That was in response to his petition that he could have filed in 1996, but waited till 2014.
Now, I might be wrong, but isn't there an argument of forfeiture that it wasn't argued below? Is that this case?
They're arguing that we waived it by the stipulation. Yes. We argued latches in the trial court. And we argued latches in the Court of Appeals.
Did you preserve that in the Court of Appeals?
Yes. It wasn't addressed.
I don't have the math in front of me, but so you raised it in 2014. And how many years after the judgment of conviction is that?
18.
I'm sorry.
But again, but don't hold the state to that, because we were in no position to argue latches until he filed his habeas petition that he could have filed in 1996. Because Knight was on the books for 4 years. Rothering was on the books for 1 year. So he knew to challenge his effective counsel, he had to file a habeas petition somewhere, and he waited till 2014 to do
what
it.
And that's when the
state argued latches.
What was the year of the stipulation?
2016.
I didn't hear that. Is that?
That was after the Court of Appeals remanded for the fact-finding hearing. And after the trial judge, the fact-finding judge made findings that the notice of intent was not filed and that Mr. Pope tried to get his attorney to file it to no avail. And that made it difficult to pursue any claim that he's not entitled to review direct post-conviction relief, but nonetheless we maintained that latches still apply.
Counsel, to what are you trying to apply latches? I mean, obviously, as we said just last term, that latches can be asserted against a writ of habeas, but that's not the issue before us. We're on direct appeal now. So against what would you be asserting latches?
I guess I would have two responses to that. We are on direct appeal. However, I believe that latches can be argued on direct appeal. I think Coleman contemplates it. And if that's unsatisfactory, on the other hand, also, the second point I'd like to make is...
No, hang on a second. Latches with respect to what? I mean, are you...
With regard to the merits, with regard to his ability to prove the merits. This is real difficult because we're operating on a direct appeal where no error is being alleged. And so we're... if he wants to claim ineffective assistance, if he wants to claim some trial error, then latches we would believe that Coleman allows us to argue latches. But before that, we would argue that latches should have applied at the Knight proceeding before and that's why I made the argument about the stipulation that. That because of material mistakes in fact and law, latches should have been considered at the Knight proceeding itself.
Right, but the writ petition, that's a collateral proceeding. That's done and over with. Right, so I just procedurally, I don't know how, if we were to agree that you should be allowed to assert latches, I'm not sure how that would happen. Do we reopen the habeas petition?
That's one option. However, I think, is
the habeas petition before us?
Well, I think that this really, even though we're on a direct appeal now, this is a direct outgrowth of a habeas petition. This doesn't happen unless habeas relief is granted, and so we're still in the realm of habeas. And for them to argue that this really isn't equity is the relief they request, which is reversal of a conviction where no error was alleged or proved, seems to me sounds inequity. And you should be able to provide an equitable defense to such radical relief. And it would be certainly unfair to the state and inequitable to the state and to the victims' families who are sitting behind to say, you can't try to prove that no error occurred. You can't argue that they unreasonably delayed to your prejudice.
Counsel, I have two questions I'd like you to help me think through a little bit. One of the arguments I thought you were making, and I suppose this is not really lashes in this situation, but a different concept, was that the reason he doesn't have the transcript is really partially his fault, too. And I wanted you to address that, because one of the things that is mentioned in the Perry case is this idea that, we're not going to hold somebody accountable for the missing transcript. In fact, it actually says, it's quoting De Leon, whereas here a portion of the record is lost through no fault of the aggrieved party, that party should not be made to bear the burden of the loss. And I thought part of your argument was that it was really his responsibility, and maybe just out there and hear your response to, and then I have one other question as well. At the initial time he filed his motion seeking to reinstate his appeal rights or an extension of the right time to file an appeal back in 97, or I think it was, the Court of Appeals heard that and, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, basically said, you told your counsel to file an appeal. He didn't do so. So let's presume for the moment you didn't receive effective assistance of counsel and there's automatic prejudice. But it's still your fault because you did nothing. You still sat on your rights for 14 months, and therefore we're not gonna give you your appeal rights back. And then subsequently, the other courts relied on that decision. And so I thought part of your argument was, listen, we can hold him responsible for asserting his rights. He didn't do so in a timely manner. In fact, he's at fault for the fact that we're 20 years later and we have no transcript because he sat on his rights. And therefore, he should still be held to his burden.
Well, I think so, because the reason why he lost in 1997 is because he didn't show good cause.
Right.
It doesn't take a lawyer to allege good cause. He knew he had to. The public defender told him in the letter, you have to give him a reason. And he had the wherewithal to make that argument, because look at his Knight petition. Look at the affidavit he filed in his Knight petition. In support of his Knight, which I think is document 43 on the record. That affidavit alleges things that were in his mind in 1997,
well, in fact,
when he filed a motion for an extension of time.
Well, in fact, that's what the Court of Appeals basically said, is you haven't given us any reason, right? Why you waited so long. And just my follow-up that I want you to address, because one of the Justice Dallet asked a question earlier, essentially, saying to your opposing counsel, should we hold him to his responsibility, even presuming he didn't have effective assistance of counsel? Should we hold him up to some standard of asserting his own rights? And your opposing counsel basically said, listen, if he had ineffective assistance of counsel, we can't hold him to it personally. And it seems to me the Court of Appeals, and I thought your argument was, yes, we can, and I'd like you to expand on that.
Well, I think... He knew that his attorney had not filed this, and so he could do one of two things. He could either retain counsel, ask for the appointment of counsel, or proceed pro se and try to get this reinstated. He filed a motion for an extension of time. He didn't support it with a showing of good cause that's required. He had the wherewithal to do it, as we see, even though it was 18 years later. Everything he alleged and everything he testified to at the evidentiary hearing were things that he could have easily put into his motion, including the two letters that he wrote to counsel in July of 1996, a few days after his sentencing. He could have attached that to his motion and might have gotten the relief back in 97 that he's seeking now.
So we want to put on pro se defendants the savviness to know exactly which documents to file at what time and to do so within a period of time that like a, I don't know, a couple months, 6 months, whatever you're saying that he should have done, is that, I mean, that's what you're saying. This is on Mr. Pope. And by the way, he did ask for assistance of counsel, and he was denied because his attorney had never filed a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief. So here's
right,
a man
and
who's being
was...
told he can't have an attorney, but you expect that he is to then know, he's to be savvy enough within those 14 months to file these things, or to file, find the jailhouse lawyer to do it for him, right?
Well, I don't think you need a lawyer to explain why you delayed 14 months.
Why a pro se defendant in prison who is filing things and is making an attempt and sending letters to his attorney, why you think that they're held to the same, you want to hold that person to the same standard an attorney would, which an attorney should file within 14 months if they saw something, right?
Well, again, it would have been very easy for him to allege, as good cause, I sent two letters to my attorney, one on July 6, one on July 18, they're attached, and my mother tried to contact him three or four times as he testified at the evidentiary hearing, and to no avail. Nobody's responded. I keep trying. There was nothing like that alleged. That probably would have turned the trick, and he didn't do that. And the Court of Appeals, and then the Court of Appeals said you didn't show good cause. He didn't petition.
But he has the constitutional rights to an attorney on a direct appeal. So what I'm hearing is that in circumstances where through no fault of his own, he's abandoned by counsel, counsel doesn't do what counsel has an obligation to do, then we're supposed to shift the burden onto the defendant to get things right.
We see cases time and time again where pro se litigants have pursued relief because the attorney fell down on the job. We've seen night petitions all the time. We see rothering petitions all the time. We see motions for extension of time that are granted because they showed good cause. This is nothing unusual.
Okay, I want you to directly answer. I think it's a great question that Justice Bradley just asked. We may see those things, but are you saying essentially that we're to shift the burden on the defendant to get things right? Because we've seen it in other cases, that's what we're supposed to do.
Well, we're at a point now where he has counsel, he is litigating a direct appeal, and because we're missing the transcript through no fault of the state, he has a minimal burden to allege some colorable claim of error, and he hasn't done it.
Okay, but you've gone away from that initial question. I'm back at the 14 months. And your argument today, if we accept it, is that it is the responsibility of a pro se defendant abandoned by counsel to prove and to get things right to show good cause. That was his responsibility, and we should put the burden on him. That is what you're saying, correct?
He is responsible to show good cause, represented or unrepresented.
Counsel, I want to return to what I would call clean hands. You're pointing at the other side and saying you're late, and you can't do what you want. I looked again. It doesn't appear to me that you've, in any court below, advanced the argument that you're advancing now that the stipulation should be vacated. On page 10 of the reply brief of your opposing counsel, and then I had my staff check it out also. It seems that there was no argument made by the state below to vacate the stipulation. And they examined the briefs filed in the Court of Appeals, and there was no argument to vacate this stipulation. You're making that argument here. Why haven't you forfeited that argument?
Well, it was argued at the trial court.
Was it preserved in the Court of Appeals? It wasn't in the...
Well, we argued lapses in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals didn't need to reach it.
My question deals with this, as I specifically asked. It deals with your argument that the stipulation should be vacated. Did you or did you not argue that below in the Court of Appeals?
Not in the Court of Appeals. But we did argue latches. We believe that latches still applies regardless of
sure,
the stipulation.
I understand, but I, The way that I see it, and I just want to be careful, so you did not argue, as you're arguing here today before this court, that the stipulation should be vacated. You didn't argue that in the Court of Appeals. Are you sure you argued that the stipulation should be vacated in the circuit court? I don't know the
yes,
answer.
Yes, it's in the transcript.
Okay,
it's argued at length.
Okay, but not in
and
the
district attorney, the assistant district attorney argued that.
Okay.
It made the same argument that it's invalid because
okay.
there was this misunderstanding.
But that argument wasn't preserved in the Court of Appeals then, that the stipulation should be vacated.
It was not preserved in the Court of Appeals. At this point, we felt that, well, again, as I pointed out, we believe laches applies with or without that stipulation. But again, as the appellant, Mr. Pope, as any litigant challenging any judgment, must allege some error. And the fact, and then when that, and if the record's deficient because of a missing transcript, Perry gives him an out from a, it prevents him from otherwise losing an appeal that has a deficient record and no allegations of error. Perry gives him an out and says, if you can identify colorable claims of error that did occur even without the transcript, we'll go back into the trial court and try to reconstruct that so you can prove your claim and win an appeal that you would otherwise lose. Mr. Pope chose not to avail himself of the Perry procedures. So he's proceeding with an appeal that has no allegations of error and what he says is a deficient record. Any person challenging a direct judgment, directly challenging a judgment, would lose. Perry gave him that out. He chooses not to avail himself of that opportunity. And therefore, that's his choice. He refuses to identify any error. So we have to presume that this conviction is valid. 23 years later, there's nothing to indicate that it's invalid. And in the interests of fairness and justice and finality of criminal convictions and decency to the victims and their families, I urge this court to affirm the succinct, correct decision of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Counsel, I hate to presume, but I'd like to just jump in because it's real short, and I just have a question for you. And I have a hypothetical here based upon some of the back and forth. Imagine for a moment, Mr. Pope, you have the same situation early on. His counsel doesn't file the appeal, and he sits on it for 20 years. And then he files a motion to have his appeal rights reinstated. Does he have any obligation, assuming he's been denied effective assistance of counsel by not having his appeal filed, does he have any obligation to do anything in a timely manner, or is the rule, as I thought you answered early on, that he has none because once he's been denied effective assistance of counsel and the appeal, you know, he doesn't have any further obligation?
I think if no effort had been made for 20 years and he filed, you're indicating he would file a night petition or alleging ineffective assistance?
Anything. He sat for 20 years. He did nothing. He received ineffective assistance of counsel and not having his appeal filed. He did nothing for 20 years. Do we put any responsibility on him?
I think in that situation, the state may have a laches claim, although, again, where there's a constitutional, where the defendant has been unwillingly deprived of their constitutional right to counsel, it's questionable, I think, whether laches can even apply in that situation. But it would depend, I think, on the circumstance, whether the defendant could establish that he had requested that counsel file the notice of intent.
Your answer in your opening argument was that he cannot have any responsibility placed on him personally. When he's been denied his assistance of counsel, he doesn't have any obligation to do anything. And now I hear you saying, well, maybe he does if he's waited a really long time. That's a different of degree, not of authority here. And so it seems to me the answer is either yes, he has an obligation, how much of one is a different question, or no, he doesn't. And I hear you playing both sides of the field.
My answer is it would depend on the facts of, again, here we have a situation where it was clear that he was deprived because he checked the box. And
but that's a matter of degree. Your answer then is maybe a reversal of what you said before. He does have some responsibility. You just don't think it was met here.
I don't think that Mr. Pope in this situation had any responsibility to, again, I don't think that Perry was anticipated to apply to a situation where no transcripts exist. I don't think Mr. Pope did anything wrong here in terms of the state's assertion that he should have ordered the transcripts, that he should have done more. I think this court's recent decision in State ex rel Lopez-Quintero answers that question, because under 973.18 sub 5, counsel, he had the right to have, that makes it mandatory upon trial counsel to file the notice of intent, and trial counsel did not do so.
Counsel, if we agree with your argument, what is to prevent defendants who have convictions that are 20, 30 years old, who didn't request an appeal for who knows what reason? And so no transcripts were ever ordered, and likely no transcripts exist anymore. Why shouldn't they each one parade before us in exactly the same posture your client has, saying, I really did want it. I really did want it, but my counsel didn't do it.
I think that would be a very difficult circumstance for a defendant to show. Again, we are in direct appeal here. This is not a habeas action.
Well, all they have to do is bring a habeas, and they'll put themselves right back in the situation that we're in now.
Respectfully, I would disagree, Your Honor. I believe they would have to file the habeas petition. The state could then raise latches, and I think it's very rare that a circumstance where someone had sat on their hands for more than a few years, honestly, but the situation that you're positing where the transcripts would have been destroyed, the reinstatement is not going to occur in that circumstance. I mean, this is a very unusual, very clear that Mr. Pope wanted to appeal his case, his trial lawyer.
I understand the merits of what you're arguing. My concern is the many, many convictions that are out there where there never was a transcript prepared because for whatever reason, no appeal was initiated. And I can't imagine a person that's incarcerated, many people, not making some type of a motion or trying to put something in play so that now, well, he was denied effective assistance of counsel to file an appeal because counsel wasn't participating. I mean, it seems to me what you're asking us to do is an extraordinarily light standard in that essentially you're saying Mr. Pope has no responsibility, none at all, and he didn't even show good cause when the court initially asked him, well, why did you wait so long? Why did you wait 14 months? He could have said, well, I called, or my mom called, my sister contacted. He knew I wanted to. I checked the box. He said absolutely nothing. So you don't, if we agree with you, there's nothing that really has to be said by the defendant to put the train on the track to getting a new trial.
Again, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I believe much more would have to be shown than what Your Honor is indicating. This is a very unusual circumstance under these facts, but it is my position, and again, I see my red light is on, but if I could just sum up, it is my position that because Mr. Pope was denied his meaningful right to appeal, including his right to counsel, prejudice should be presumed in this case without showing under Perry. But if the court does choose to expand Perry to require showing of an error, we would ask for remand so that he can allege whatever potential error could be alleged.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for a very interesting and obviously a difficult case, no matter how you look at this. So we will take a brief recess now so that other counsel can come in for the next case. We are adjourned.